Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Joe Donahue. Here on this Medical Monday to discuss cardiology is Dr. Reed Muller of Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. Dr. Muller was selected to America's Top Cardiologist by the Consumers Research Council in 2006, 2008, 2009. Congratulations. That seems like a big deal. I assume that's a big deal. It seems like a big deal.
Well, it's nice to be honored by the patients and to be recognized for your ability.
He's a member of the American College of Cardiology, the National Board of Echocardiography, and many others. He's also a former state air surgeon with the New York Air National Guard, retiring with the rank of colonel in March of 2012. To be a part of today's conversation, all you have to do is call us, 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Reed Muller, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
When do most people learn that they need to go to a cardiologist?
Unfortunately, many people learn they need to go to a cardiologist when they're sitting in the emergency room. But the fortunate ones recognize that they may be having a problem, and that it could be related to the heart or circulation, and come to our attention through the office setting.
What do we know about demographics? Your typical patient, or is there no such thing?
The demographics have been changing. Typically, we used to think of the middle-aged white male.
Yeah.
But the demographics have definitely been changing. At least 50%, sometimes more on a given week, of my patient population is female. There's a large percentage of Hispanics and African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And heart disease often tends to follow other health problems. So when you look at the population of people who suffer, say, from diabetes, obesity, hypertension, you're frequently going to see heart disease in that population.
Is there any accounting for why those numbers are changing, why those demographics have changed?
I think part of it is we're paying more attention.
Okay. Which is good.
Absolutely. We have learned, for instance, that heart disease tends to present itself often very differently in women than it does in men, particularly when you look at something like heart failure and when you look at something like coronary disease. The manifestations, the bases for those problems often can be very different in women than in men.
When it comes to the use of the word heart disease, if you are, that's a big umbrella, right? I mean, that can
Absolutely.
Be anything that brings you in regarding your heart.
You bet.
Yeah. And what makes it the disease in the sense of something that is
Sure.
that allows it to be something that is prevalent?
Well, I often tell my patients that heart disease, the phrase, is kind of a garbage can term
Right.
that covers a multitude of sins. But when many laymen think of heart disease, of course, they're thinking of heart attacks and angina.
Right.
But that's just one small portion of a whole variety of different diseases of the heart and circulation. You also have heart failure. You have various heart valve problems. There are certain infections of the heart. There's a whole long laundry list of different rhythm problems you can develop with the heart. Those are all forms of heart disease, but they may have different treatments. They may have different origins. And oftentimes, people may have several of these things at the same time.
Dr. Reed Muller is our guest on Medical Monday this afternoon. We welcome your phone calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-34-TALK-1, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. When you think of, I guess I'm interested in the changing of the demographics. Are there things that are trends in the way of you see yourself dealing with more cases of this now than you did, say, 5 years ago?
Yes, actually, and that's very much ties in with my own personal interests, because as with a number of other specialties, we tend to subspecialize.
Right.
And my particular area is advanced heart failure. So looking at things like transplants and pump assist devices, things like that. And very interestingly, when I first went into practice, that was not what I was focused on at all. I was mostly focused on coronary disease and heart attacks. And that was because at that point we couldn't do much for heart failure. If you had a diagnosis of heart failure 30 years ago, you had a prognosis of about 6 months.
Yeah.
Nowadays, heart failure is like a chronic illness, like treating high blood pressure or diabetes. There's so many things that we can do to treat it now that people can live years and almost normal lifespans with heart failure. There's so much more we can offer to make the patient better, feel better, do better.
And I assume, as you were saying, you know, a lot of times the first time you see your patient is when there is an issue. So the sooner you get to any of these, the better, I would
guess.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. I have always told patients, I'm a heck of a lot cheaper and easier when you come to me before you're sick than after you're sick.
But most people, I would assume that most people say, would go to the cardiologist for the first time, unless there's an issue, but if their GP says, okay,
yes,
you know, it's time for you to check
that's,
out.
That's often what happens.
Yeah.
Many of our referrals come from the primary care community.
Right. And the primary, I know my personal case, went to the primary care doctor, did the usual 6 months checkup, check you out, and then he said, yeah, I want you to go see my friend, the cardiologist.
Mm-hmm. That's happens every day.
Yeah. But that also can be preventive in some way, or at least getting it early.
Very much so, because the primary care docs frequently will see some subtle change. Maybe they'll see that your cholesterol is creeping up, and they know that perhaps there was a history in your family of some issues, and that may prompt them to say, you know, I think you ought to see a cardiologist and just make sure there's nothing else lurking in the background here that we need to know about.
I do want to get to that idea of what we can do to prevent. I also want to get to our phone calls here. We have a few of them. We welcome yours. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-34-TALK-1. We're talking cardiology on Midday Magazine this afternoon. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Mueller right after this. Medical Monday on Vox Pop this afternoon. We're talking about cardiology and doing so with Dr. Reed Mueller of Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. We begin with Joan in Altamont. Joan, go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondered, I do have a cardiologist, and maybe a year and a half ago I had a negative stress test, but my blood pressure seems low lately when I take it, and I was concerned about the pulse pressure. You know, it's at the top is 30, at the low it's 15. Seems to vary. 78 years old, good cholesterol under control, but just didn't know about that pulse pressure, if I should be concerned about it.
Sure. Well, the blood pressure is divided into two numbers, the systolic, which is the upper or the higher number, and the diastolic, which is the lower number. And they're both important, and the pulse pressure represents the difference between those two numbers. Mm. The upper number generally is the pressure that's associated with the contraction of the heart and the force it generates in your aorta. And then the diastolic pressure is the residual pressure in the arteries that's there once the heart stops contracting. So that's the pressure in between heartbeats. And it's actually that number that's responsible for ensuring blood flow, for instance, to the arteries in the heart itself. And the pulse pressure is what kind of drives flow through the other organs to the rest of the body. So you want to have a sufficient difference between the two numbers to ensure that there's adequate flow, but you also want to make sure that there's neither too little pressure nor too much pressure, because too much of a difference in the pulse pressure can be a reflection of other cardiovascular problems. It's kind of like the Goldilocks conundrum, finding the right thing.
And as far as the, you have the stress test, everything's okay, and then you still have the low blood pressure, do those often, do they go hand in hand or not necessarily?
Well, the stress test is really a test designed to look for evidence of blocked arteries, specifically arteries feeding the heart. So it's designed to look for evidence of a problem that could lead to a heart attack, for instance. You can often see problems with the blood pressure in folks who've got serious blockages. Frequently, what I see as somebody is developing a significant blockage in the heart, their blood pressure may actually go up because the heart is trying to generate more pressure to maintain blood flow across those blocked arteries.
Joan, does that help you?
Yeah, but I wondered about the ejection fraction, because I could understand the higher numbers, but sometime I'll take it as like 88 and 64. Well, you know, seems awful low, and I'm not an athlete. You know, I swim.
Well, get on that.
Now and then. You know, so, I mean.
One of the things I
don't know, do you?
One of the things I look at, John, when folks, particularly older folks, you know, come to me with lower blood pressures, is what medications are they taking? Could perhaps there be a need to make an adjustment in one or other of their medications?
Right.
Is there also perhaps a need to hydrate better? Oftentimes I find that patients run lower blood pressures, particularly this time of year, because they are simply not hydrating well enough.
Joan, thank you very much for the telephone call. We appreciate it. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, go ahead.
Is coronavirus more likely to affect myocarditis or endocarditis?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We've seen, obviously, in the last 15, 16 months, quite a few patients with COVID, unfortunately. Predominantly what it causes when it affects the heart is myocarditis, and that's because of the immune response, the inflammatory response that the COVID infection causes throughout your system. Endocarditis is actually an infectious process of the heart that's typically caused by a bacterial infection or sometimes by a fungal infection. It's not generally caused by a virus. Viruses tend to cause myocarditis and not endocarditis.
And that myocarditis is an inflammation of the heart?
It's an inflammation of the heart muscle cells themselves.
Okay.
Yes. And it can cause permanent damage or transient damage. Fortunately, most of what we've seen with COVID is transient.
We welcome your letters, panel. It's I knew I was going to do that. VoxPop at WAMC.org, VoxPop at WAMC.org. You can also call us 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to some letters. We have quite a few for you, Doctor. Heart arrhythmia, says Lisa, runs in my family. My brother's cardiologist did a hybrid ablation to treat his. I have seen two different cardiologists and have not had any procedures, just treated with... is it metoprolol?
Metoprolol.
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 There you go. Should I seek another opinion? Asks Lisa.
Well, each case has to be treated individually. There are a variety of treatments for any number of heart rhythm problems. Sometimes the best treatment is medication. Sometimes it is a procedure. A lot depends on the nature of the specific rhythm problem, because there are literally hundreds of different rhythm problems. And it also depends on how well something like medication is controlling the problem. If it's a relatively mild situation and the patient's well controlled with no breakthrough episode, sometimes medication is the best way to go. The ablation procedures are very, very effective, and we use them widely, but they are invasive procedures, which means we have to stick something inside the body to accomplish the procedure. Mm. And of course, that always carries the potential, however small, for bad things to happen. And so we tend to reserve those procedures for situations that are more serious or less easily controlled with medications.
All right, let's go to another phone call and check in with Paul from Schenectady, who has a couple of questions. Paul, go ahead.
Hey there. Maybe I'll squeeze in a third. The first question is,
okay,
should you take blood pressure on both arms? I read that. It makes sense to me intellectually.
And it makes sense medically as well.
Okay. All right. Secondly, I didn't hear you earlier. Secondly, as you age, I've read and believed intuitively that, I'll bring up God, that your body should, in fact, naturally have higher blood pressure because of the veins being tighter, and that meddling with a working system. My mother lived till 96,
right,
and she was given a mild blood pressure med. She tossed it, you know, at some point. I didn't fight it, and it just didn't make any sense to me, and it was intuitive crossing, Googling around, reading. What's your thought on that?
Well, that actual philosophy was something that governed the treatment of hypertension for many years. And based on millions of patient years of data and research, we actually tossed that philosophy out about 15, 20 years ago, because the reason the blood pressure is seen to frequently go up as you age is because the incidence of hypertension goes up consistently as we age. No, it's not normal for elderly people to run high blood pressures. It's not simply a function of aging. It's a function of hypertension. And under the international guidelines for the treatment of hypertension, it's now recommended that the blood pressure be treated regardless of your age.
Paul, thanks very much for the call. I want to follow up on his first question, which was the taking blood pressure in both the right and left arms. You said that it is good medically, makes good medical sense.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I frequently get referred patients to consult on for difficult to control hypertension.
Right.
And the first thing I do is I check the blood pressure in both arms, because oftentimes you will find that in a given patient there may be a substantial difference in blood pressures in one arm or the other. And that can be for any number of reasons. Sometimes it's due to congenital abnormalities of the circulation, things like coarctation of the aorta. Sometimes it's because patients have developed blockages in the arteries to one or the other arm. See that very frequently, for instance, in long-term heavy smokers.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes a problem because you may have somebody checking the blood pressure in a patient in the left arm, and the left arm looks just fine. But when you check the blood pressure in the right arm, the blood pressure in the right arm is substantially higher.
Yeah, so it's not fine.
And so what we're taught in medical school is check both arms and then always go with a higher number.
So when you then send the patient out and say, check your blood pressure regularly, will you tell them, and by the way, it's probably better if you check it on the left than the right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And what I frequently do with those folks is I also have them bring their cuff in to the office so I can compare their cuff to our cuff and see how closely they correlate.
Yes. My doctor made me do that too. And I assume that, and there can be, and you see the difference, right? I mean, it's obviously you're using better equipment.
Oftentimes their cuffs are quite accurate, yeah. But I just want to make sure that they what are correlating, with. Or if they're not, how much of a difference is there?
Right. Let's go to Eduardo in Albany. Eduardo, good afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to ask a question. What is the effect of nutrition, good or bad nutrition, developing heart problems? That's my question.
Well, that's an excellent
question.
In other
words, what you eat, what yeah. you eat.
You are what you eat, doctor. That's what they tell us.
That is an excellent question.
To heart problems. And I'll listen.
All right. Thanks, Eduardo.
You know, he raises probably one of the most important cornerstones of the prevention of many forms of heart disease, which is a good diet. And eating a heart healthy, or what is often referred to as a Mediterranean diet, is a cornerstone in both the prevention and management of many cardiac problems, including high blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
as well as other illnesses like diabetes, which from my way of thinking is simply another risk factor for heart disease. So by following a diet that's low in animal fats, that's low in salt, you're dramatically reducing your risk for many types of heart-related problems down the road. And it's the cornerstone of management. It's the first thing we recommend to our patients in the office.
Is there an agreed-to heart-healthy diet?
Well, the one that we recommend most commonly is what's referred to as a Mediterranean-style diet.
Right.
So there's less beef, less pork, more fish, more fruits, nuts, and vegetables, more plant-based fats rather than animal-based fats. And it's generally much lower in salt. They use healthier oils to cook, like olive oil. And that's kind of a basic heart-healthy diet.
Dr. Reed Muller is our guest on Vox Pop today and Medical Monday. We are taking your calls about cardiology. You certainly also can write to us, voxpop@wamc.org. That is how Joanne submitted her question. What effect does donating blood take on the heart and the body?
Well, donating a unit of blood is the same as getting temporarily dehydrated.
Okay.
So the typical response of the heart would be to start beating faster until that volume is replaced. And that's one of the reasons why the Red Cross gives you the juice and the cookies and the stuff to have afterwards to help your body start replacing what was lost. Your body has an amazing capability of doing that, but fundamentally, it's the same as getting temporarily dehydrated.
But as a cardiologist, you wouldn't tell people not to give blood.
There are some cases where they should not,
mm-hmm.
Particularly folks who have particularly severe types of
right.
heart failure, for instance, or unstable forms of coronary disease. And oftentimes, because of the medications they're on, they might be prohibited from donating anyway.
Mark writes and says, in order to control blood pressure, some cardiologists prescribed ACE inhibitors, while others put their patients on beta blockers, and then there are the calcium channel blockers. What is the science behind these, and why does a cardiologist prescribe one type of medication versus another?
We tend to prescribe, and I use all three of those types of medications. There are guidelines internationally for the management of hypertension, and those guidelines basically tell you that pretty much any one of those medications can be a good first-line agent for the treatment of hypertension. We tend to gravitate towards the ones that we are most familiar with, that we have the most experience with, and feel most comfortable with, and then oftentimes we'll mix and match. Many patients, we have to use more than one medication to control the blood pressure. They all tend to work differently in terms of their effects on the blood vessels and how they cause the blood vessels to mm-hmm. relax. But fundamentally, that's how they work, is by causing the blood vessels to relax. And so the pressure within those vessels drops.
Try to slip in one phone call here before we have to go to another break. This is Robert in Stone Ridge. Robert, go ahead.
afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to know if a calcium score of over 600 is in and of itself a reason to have an exploratory catheterization. I know there's a bit of a blockage through a stress test, but we're not sure how much.
That's actually an excellent question, and one I get quite frequently because cardiac CAT scanning is one of the things I do.
Yeah.
A calcium score of 600 is certainly a cause for concern because it means that there's a significant amount of plaque in the coronary arteries. However, it's a two-dimensional picture of a three-dimensional structure, and that plaque could be mostly on the outside of the artery wall. It could be on the inside of the artery wall, which would be a problem, or it could be in the middle of the artery wall. Okay, it's the plaque that's on the inside of the artery wall that tends to cause the most problems. And a case in point that I give to my patients is a patient I had who had a calcium score of over 3,000, had absolutely no symptoms, and this was early in the days of doing these procedures. And so I did indeed send him for a catheterization, and his coronary arteries were pristine. That doesn't mean he doesn't have plaque. He had a lot of plaque, clearly, but none of it was in the inside of the artery. So the patient still needs to be treated. They need to have their cholesterol managed, their blood pressure treated. If they have diabetes, that needs to be treated. If they're smoking, we're obviously going to encourage them to lose the cigarettes. So their risk factors need to be addressed. But if they're not having symptoms, what I might do in somebody with a calcium score like that is I might proceed to a stress test to make sure there's no serious evidence of a blockage that's actually causing a problem. But if the stress test didn't show any serious problems, I would just focus on managing the risk factors.
If you take a stress test, and it's a stress test where they'll give you the put you through the tube, the ejection, all that stuff, and they put you through and they come back and say, well, we don't see a calcium issue there. Do you still need to have the calcium scoring?
I tend to use the calcium score before the stress test.
Okay.
So
it's more accurate?
For instance, if a patient comes into me concerned about their blood pressure and their cholesterol, and maybe they have a family history of coronary problems, and they're concerned about what's my risk, but they're not having any symptoms, I'm not really going to push to do a stress test because it's not going to be terribly helpful. What will help me more in terms of determining their long-term risk for developing coronary problems is the calcium score, because that tells me if they're already making plaque. They may not be at a point where the plaque is enough to cause them symptoms, but it tells me that they are making plaque, so this is the person I need to focus my attention on. Get that cholesterol down really well. Get that blood pressure really well controlled. Get them off the cigarettes.
Dr. Reed Muller is our guest on Vox Pop this afternoon. It's Medical Monday. We welcome your letters. You can write to us, voxpop@wamc.org. You can also call us, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Last call on all of it. We'll do our last 20 minutes together right after this short break. Welcome back to Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. We're discussing cardiology on the program this afternoon. Dr. Reed Muller is with us. He's from Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates. We're taking your phone calls at 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Okay, let's go to a couple of letters. This one from Ellie. For people with low blood pressure, what about salt intake?
Well, it's an interesting question, and the answer is it depends on how low the blood pressure is and whether it's actually causing any symptoms or problems. Many people walk around, my wife is one of them, with fairly low blood pressures.
Yeah.
But they have no symptoms at all. They're perfectly healthy, and there's no need to do anything. Some folks, however, when their blood pressure gets low, and by low I mean 90 or lower, And in those cases, oftentimes we do have to intervene. And sometimes it means liberalizing salt intake. Sometimes it means looking at medications, seeing if some medications may need to be discontinued. And in more severe cases, sometimes there's actually medications we use to help elevate the pressure a bit.
Let's go to this question from Janet, who says, can Dr. Mueller please comment on Dr. Dean Ornish's research on a super low-fat vegan diet and the reversal of heart disease?
Actually, Dean Ornish has done some great research, and to his credit, he has done the hard work over the years to do the research and prove his approaches. And at least in terms of coronary disease, there is pretty clear-cut evidence that following his diet and lifestyle modifications, you can cause some plaque reversal. You may not necessarily be able to do that in every patient, nor may you necessarily get complete plaque reversal, because calcified plaque generally will not reverse, but non-calcified plaque will. But it does work. The problem is it doesn't work in everyone. And it does entail some lifestyle changes that, quite frankly, many Americans won't put up with.
Makes it a little harder to keep with it, right?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go to Anthony, who joins us from Troy, New York. Anthony, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, Doc. Thank you, Doctor. I think you answered most of my question with Robert's call. So a follow-up would be, I have a very high calcium score of 1,000. My total cholesterol is being treated with Zetia and Crestor and hovers around 130 to 150. And I have regular stress tests that are always fine. So I think you answered the part about how can you have such a high calcium score in that situation. So as a follow-up, would the regimen of statins that I'm on start to reverse plaque buildup, or is that something that is not possible?
Well, as I had alluded to, I think in the last call, the calcified plaque is generally not going to reverse. But also the calcified plaque has already been demonstrated through your stress testing, for instance, that it's not causing you any symptoms either. What you're really trying to address is the non-calcified plaque, and that's the target of opportunity. And that's certainly where statins and other cholesterol-lowering medications are very effective. The interesting thing is people wonder, well, why don't I get the calcium score repeated to see how well it's working? And that gets to the basic physiology, because calcified plaque is what we call stabilized plaque, so it's not going to do anything to you anymore. And if you are stabilizing plaque with statin therapy, for instance, you can bet that some of that plaque is going to calcify. So oftentimes you'll actually see the calcium score go up when you're properly treating patients. It doesn't mean it's not working. It's just a function of the physiology of what happens to plaque when it stabilizes.
How does that work for you, Anthony?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the telephone call. Let's go to, we'll go to Carrie in Boyceville. Carrie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have congestive heart failure on the left side, and I'm a little confused about the ejection fraction, because in June 2020, I had a pacemaker defibrillator put in. Right before that, the ejection fraction was 15 to 20%, very low. And this year, I had a cardiac cath on June 15th, which showed the ejection fraction to be between 50 and 55%. And then July 12th, I had an echo cardiogram. It showed it still 15 to 20%. So which test is more reliable?
Well, that's a good question. There are a variety of ways that you can measure the heart's pump function, or what we refer to as the ejection fraction. But each has its pluses and minuses. One of the challenges with measuring an ejection fraction by echo, by cardiac ultrasound, particularly if a pacemaker is involved, is the effect of the pacemaker on how the walls of the heart contract can artificially make the ejection fraction or pump function look worse than perhaps it really is. And oftentimes we may rely more on what's called a MUGA scan or a catheterization result in more extreme cases to get a more accurate assessment of the pump function, because the ejection fraction may not be as accurately measured in those situations with the echocardiogram.
Okay, and it's not more reliable with the cardiac catheterization?
Again, they're all apples and oranges.
Right.
The catheterization can certainly give you an accurate ejection fraction, but it's a far more intrusive test, and so we don't do it simply to routinely measure the pump function. We tend to use other methodologies.
Gary?
Right, but I did have it, and that's what they came up with, was 55%, which makes me very happy.
Yes.
Because I was told that the pacemaker is not going to necessarily improve the ejection fraction. So,
it, depending
bottom
on the
line,
type
you're saying
of,
we don't know that it has been improved.
Well, depending on the type of device that was implanted, it can result in improvement. And, of course, obviously, I'm assuming they have you on a variety of medication as well, and oftentimes there's good response to that.
Kerry, thank you very much for the telephone call. Sam writes, it was noted during this episode that smoking cigarettes negatively affects heart health. You agree with that? Yes?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, for the kicker, asks Sam, does smoking marijuana have a similar negative effect?
The short answer is yes, because smoking is smoking, and it's not the THC in the marijuana that's causing the heart problems. It's all the other junk that's in the smoke.
Right.
You know, in regular tobacco smoke, it's not the nicotine that's causing the heart disease. It's causing the addiction, but not the heart disease. But it's all the other junk in the smoke that you're inhaling into your lungs that causes the heart disease. And the same applies to smoking cannabis.
About 8 minutes left with Dr. Mueller. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. Also, you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to Susan, who is in West Stockbridge. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Good. Hi. I'm a 78-and-a-half-year-old woman. I have osteoporosis, but I have low thyroid. And it's always been low. It's not like at 11, but last time it was, the TSH was 4.64, and the T3 was 203, the one before it was a little higher. And my endocrinologist says with women my age, she'd like to just leave it alone. And other people say it can impact your heart and bones. I have been working with a supplement. It's debatable whether it really has pig porcine in. It's called GTA. Just to do a little research, I called the company that makes Synthroid. And they have terrible things, in my opinion, in it. And I said, have you tested the talc to see if there's asbestos fiber? So to cut to the chase, even though levothyroxine has sodium lauryl sulfate, which isn't good, I don't know who to listen to. Should I leave it with what I'm doing? Maybe get off the goitrogens? I do eat broccoli, sweet potatoes, and carrots. You know, I am getting conflicting information, and you're a heart doctor, and I wondered what you thought.
We have to give Susan props for being a very good, educated patient. Yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I'm a vegan trying to make myself, when they thought I might be heading toward congestive heart failure, but they think I'm not. The pictures weren't good that year. I said, what should I do? She said, 5 days a week aerobics. Sounds good to me. Next doctor, vegan. I'm a vegan. And
all right.
I work out and I will do whatever I have to do, especially avoid medication.
Oh, sick. Okay.
So I try to emulate Dean Ornish to a big extent. I do yoga, meditation, da 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 da.
So we're running out of time. So let me have the doctor answer your question. But go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. The short answer to the question is, if your hypothyroid and the thyroid hormone is insufficient based on the TSH levels, then it does need to be treated, because long-term hypothyroidism does adversely affect the heart's pump function in particular. that ejection fraction that we were talking about. In fact, one of the worst cases of untreatable heart failure I ever saw was shortly after I went into practice, and it was a person who was in mixed edema coma after open heart surgery. Wow. And the only way we got her better was by giving her massive doses of thyroid. So, you know, the initial levels of 11 or so are certainly concerning. The subsequent levels seem to be much improved. But the thyroid clearly needs to be treated.
All right. Back to we'll go to David now in Lee, Massachusetts. David, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask the doctor if taking fish oil tablets, over-the-counter fish oil tablets, are worth the money or are they a waste of time?
Well, they're certainly worth the money to the manufacturer. I'm not sure they're doing a heck of a lot for you. The only fish oil type supplement that has been demonstrated to have any particular benefits as far as things like cholesterol and the heart is concerned is something I called eicosapentaenoic acid, and it is only available in a highly purified prescription form. The other commercially available fish oil supplements over the counter do not have sufficient concentrations of that particular compound to make them effective.
Okay, thank you. That was my belief.
All right. David, that makes two of you. Thank you very much for the phone call. Let's go to Gail, who writes to us and says, I had a minor heart attack but had no signs of high blood pressure, bad cholesterol, or high blood sugar before that. A doctor did a full blood workup and said I had sticky cholesterol. She prescribed medicine. I'm doing great now. All my numbers are even better. What is sticky cholesterol?
I frankly have no idea because I haven't heard it referred to as that.
So I would presume
they're talking about what we normally call LDL, or in my parlance, bad cholesterol. LDL okay. cholesterol is pretty much our target of treatment for most patients. There's a couple of other subcompounds like ApoB100 and LP little a, but the basic target of treatment for most patients is the LDL cholesterol, and I would presume that that's what they were referring to.
Gail does say that some other doctors say that they have never heard of that, so maybe it's an individual preference of a phrase to use of sticky cholesterol. Joanna joins us now from Saratoga Springs. Good morning, Joanna. Or good afternoon.
Hi,
I should
good
say.
Morning. Hi,
yeah,
good afternoon. Fine, I man. Want to offer a cautionary tale. And
okay.
One would think that it would be so intuitive if you were having chest pain, you would go to the hospital, especially since it was your third heart attack. Well, I had just left my cardiologist's office. He said, I think it's your lungs this time because women present so insidiously. Went shopping across town, had a heart attack in the broccoli aisle, and it was in shock, drove myself to the hospital, a local hospital, and I was totally ignored. I should have called 911, so my tale is, please, if you feel there's a problem, and you're even not sure there's a problem, call 911. I stood 5 minutes at registration waiting for other people to be checked in. Before they finally took me seriously, my LAD, which already has a bypass and it has a stent, just got another stent. It was 90% blocked. So I'm lucky to be alive. I'm fine. I'm doing gardening. But please, please tell women, especially if you feel that there is something there, just call 911.
And it's a very good point, Joanna, because if you think about it, you know, the doctor isn't going to come to the broccoli aisle, but the 911, they'll send them right there to the broccoli aisle to help you out.
Absolutely. And you know, you're in shock and you're not sure, so just take a break and call 911. All right.
About 15 seconds.
There's no such thing as crying wolf when it comes to chest pain. When I was in training, I had a woman come in 183 times for chest pain in 1 year.
Okay.
And it was always a false alarm.
That's every other day.
And the 184th time, it was the real deal.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for being with us this morning. Thank you. Or this afternoon. I'm going to do this all week. I know I'm going to. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a
great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful to meet you and very nice to have you on the program. We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to the many folks that we've left on the line. Again, our guest was Dr. Reed Muller of Albany Associates in Cardiology, a practice of St. Peter's Health Partners Medical Associates.